You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 4th to the 10th of May 2017. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by data editor Simon Baker, reporter Jack Grove and books editor Matthew Rice. If there's one issue sure to get people's backs up, then it's pay levels. But what is the picture like in UK higher education? Are salaries going up? Is the gender pay gap being addressed? These questions and many more are addressed in the annual Higher Education Pay Survey, which we published this week. Simon Baker will take us through some of the trends in just a moment. Which country is the most stressful place to work as an academic? China, perhaps? The UK? Germany? Well, Jack Grove reports this week on a study of global stress levels in higher education. He'll be able to answer that question very soon. And finally, Matthew Rice is our new books editor, and he'll be taking us through some of the highlights of this week's books section. But first, the THE Higher Education Pay Survey, Simon, was published this week. Unsurprisingly, always one of the most talked about stories of the year. It's quite an undertaking and very in-depth look at the picture of the UK sector. Maybe you'd like to tease out some of the trends that we've discovered this year.
Well, we've done it slightly differently this year in that normally what we do is we run this alongside basically our feature on Vice Chancellor pay, which is something that is still to come. But this year we've basically taken a set of data that the Higher Education Statistics Agency give us on average pay for different roles at every university, and we've just looked at that instead of just sort of tagging it at the end of a feature about Vice Chancellor pay as well. We've looked at this kind of on its own, and once you start digging into the data, you find all sorts of very interesting things. Probably the most the thing that struck me kind of the most, and something that I don't think we've really done before, is kind of you kind of take this pay data for professors, their academics, it looks at administrative staff as well, but look at it in real terms over like we can take sort of the data that we've had from the last kind of half a decade really. Adjust it for kind of inflation, and you actually really see how pay has kind of suffered in real terms over that period.
And it's across the board, isn't it? Pretty much in as far as academics go, I think there were some professional staff that had seen a real terms increase, but generally a poor picture there.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we've got more data for more years going back for professors and all academics rather than administrative staff, because just the way we've done it in the past, we sort of concentrated more on them when it came to sort of 5 years ago. But we've got an interesting graph where we basically look at the sort of difference in real-term salary compared with 2010-11 for professors and academics, for instance. And so for professors, it's still £2,500 on average less in real terms than it was in 2010-11. For all academics, if you look at all roles, then it's about £1,500 less. So basically, pay hasn't recovered since then in real terms. There's been an annual row over pay increases. UCU, the unions always say that, you know, we've suffered in real terms this much. The employers kind of say, well, you know, every job in the economy has suffered. You haven't got it quite as bad as some others. You know, I mean, you can argue that might be true when you look at sort of school teachers. I know that they've their pay has been been frozen quite, you know, for in some years, and has probably deteriorated more in real terms, and some professions will be worse. But it does really illustrate how that pay, even in universities, which some say have had lots of money due to tuition fees, hasn't really recovered over the years post the sort of banking crash recession.
And the other line that came out of your work was in relation to the gender pay gap. Now, obviously, all companies more than 200 employers are going to be forced to publish their gender pay information from next year. We know quite a bit about the university situation already, and again, it wasn't the sort of most encouraging of findings in this year's pay survey.
No, I mean, we have looked at this every year. I suppose the kind of slightly disappointing thing in terms of the figures was that if you look at professorial pay gaps, gender pay gaps, I mean, it's pretty much stayed static. fact, it crept up very slightly. I mean, probably an insignificant amount in terms, you know, statistically, but it hasn't really. It's not falling. Whereas you look at all academics, it is continuing to fall. Mm. The pay gap, if you look at the sort of mean salaries. But so that you might sort of immediately say, well, why has progress stalled? I mean, there's various different things you could say that might be due to. I mean, it could be that more female professors are being appointed in various institutions, but they're starting off at a lower pay band when it comes to professors at those institutions. And so, you know, that influences the average salary, and that's kind of the reason that, you know, some employers kind of gave, really.
Mm.
But on the other hand, you know, there will be a lot of people who are very frustrated that we know there's a problem. It's quite clear that, you know, the reasons for the problem, it's to do with kind of segregation in the workplace, which is a historic issue to do with women working in different academic disciplines. They're more likely to be in some disciplines than others. It's the problem of the leaky pipeline of when women are less women sometimes promoted for various different reasons, and that's something that, you know, the sector's been addressing through Athena Swan and lots of other schemes. But people will be generally probably frustrated that it doesn't seem to be translating quickly into an equalising of the pay gap. And that's what's led some institutions like the University of Essex and LSE to take more drastic action, actually, in the last sort of year or so.
Indeed. Well, you can read all about those issues in more detail and more nuance, of course, in Simon's feature. It's in this week's magazine. It is also on timeshighereducation.com, as indeed all the articles we discussed today are. Moving on, though, to the news section, Jack, and you've been looking at a study of sort of academic workplace pressures and looking a bit at, you know, where the most stressed academics are. Put listeners out of their misery. Where are the most stressed academics in the world?
Well, in short, China. But this I'll just say a bit more. This is a study by a Swedish professor of education. He has looked at all the available sort of surveys on workplace satisfaction and stress and all the things that's out there, including, I think he'd surveyed something like 37 countries, and he has brought them together and compiled his own sort of rather subjective ranking, because I suppose you have to be quite subjective in this sense, but according to his assessment, China is the most stressed out place to work. And the UK is somewhere in the middle. It's on a par with Nigeria, Peru, Romania, Colombia, places where you might imagine they've got a bit more sort of stress for various reasons. But it's, and actually the UK is more stressed. If you work in the UK, generally, you're more stressed than if you work in a university in Uganda or Turkey. Well, Turkey, given where they're sacking lots of academics, that's quite surprising. But apparently the happiest place to work is Germany. And he basically equates, well, he says that the sort of imposition of performance management and various sort of types of control by universities is causing a lot of stress in UK universities.
So the research excellence framework, the upcoming these kind of things.
And places like Germany that don't have these systems, people are less stressed. They have their own systems, but they're quite German and quite sort of, you know, they engage with academics on their own terms rather than what he says trying to impose an industrial model of management on academia, which involves sort of constant change, constant improvement. That really stresses academics out.
Indeed. Well, you can read all about that study on page 6 this week and on the website too, of course. And a little further back in the magazine, though of course no less important, is our books section, Matthew, which you've recently taken over. Perhaps we should start with some highlights from this week's book section. Would like to take us through it.
Yeah, sure. The lead review is by Danny Dorling, and it's about one of the first major attempts to analyse exactly why Britain voted for Brexit and going through all the explanations, how much the Boris factor counted, how much whether Britain is more racist than other countries, the role of UKIP, the role of newspapers and so on, but trying to tackle these issues in a serious academic way rather than just speculating about it like everyone has been doing. So that's a major book reviewed by one of our lead star reviewers.
It's a shame everyone's fed up with experts, really, isn't it, if this is an authoritative account?
Yes, well, it'll be interesting to see whether it sells lots of copies or whether, by definition, people say we don't want to hear it, or we're fed up with Brexit, of course. But anyway, that's a major book. There's a very entertaining review by Robert Eagleston about the origins of cool in the post-war world, and he tackles the question about, he explains why Billie Holiday and Humphrey Bogart are cool and why most academics will never be, often to their great distress, but I think that's the way it is. There's a review about American families dealing with economic precariousness, not having enough money at the end of each month, and the kind of stratagems they use to deal with that. And there's also a review about people trafficking in China. So it's quite a wide range of topics, as always, both directly political and policy relevant, and also more distant and academic.
Mm. And your plans for this section, Matthew?
Well, it's hard to know exactly what I'm going to do. I haven't quite got my head around the sheer number of books that arrive on my desk each week, or indeed each day. But I think what I can say is that I'm building on excellent book pages which Karen Shook created. I'm certainly bringing in some new reviewers, possibly trying to review in slightly new areas. But the key point is, of course, that I'm always looking for academics who want to review books for us. So please approach me, and I'll be very sympathetic.
Indeed, and one of the most entertaining sections of that book section for me personally is the "What Are You Reading?" Section, where we hear from scholars and their current the books that are currently on their bedside tables, as it were. And I know we're on the lookout for people to take part in that too. If you're that person, you can reach Matthew on matthew.rice@timeshighereducation.com or click the Contact Us page on our website. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed in today's podcast, you can do so on our website at timeshighereducation.com. You'll also find us on Twitter, on LinkedIn, and on Facebook too, so do get in touch. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.